Hello and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. I am joined by my co-host, Max Linsky, and my other co-host, Aaron Lammer, both from Long Form.
Hey.
What's up, guys?
Aaron's back.
Apparently an episode happened while I was gone without my knowledge.
But you had a good time in New Orleans. It was worth it.
You know, the funny thing is I listened to that episode and I did not notice that I was not on the intro.
I'm sure other people did.
Yeah. I know I've got my fans out there. Shout outs to the Aaron Lammer fans listening. Who do we have on the show today?
This week I talked to Michael Paternity, who is the author of two books, both of which I love, and so many great magazine stories that we could not possibly talk about them all. I realized by the end we had not talked about stories that I really like.
Yeah,
the guy's been nominated for a National Magazine Award like 8 times.
Yeah, he's one of those guys where it's just like impossible to get to the whole list.
Is that really famous story he did, like eating Jack Hooker's cow? Is that like his first story? His first big story? Do you know what story I'm talking about? It's about like competing motels, I believe, in Kansas City, like the really, really low rent motels.
That might be his first story. He did a story about Thurman Munson.
Yeah, that's from the same vintage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he might even talk about the Kansas City thing a little bit.
I could be wrong about it being Kansas City. It's somewhere in that region.
Somewhere in the general, like, Midwest.
Yeah. It's a very memorable story.
Anyway, he's fantastic. He's really interesting.
What's his new book called?
His new book is called The Telling Room.
The Telling Room. It's about cheese, right?
Yeah, it's about cheese, but so much more. Yeah. I think it's just out in paperback, or it's about to be out in paperback.
Right on.
Do we have any sponsors this week?
We do. We have a couple. There is a new book from Atavist Books. You guys know Atavist Books?
Atavist Books, full disclosure, not the same thing as the Atavist that Evan is part of. A different venture that's interlinked and software in common.
Yeah. Correct.
And this book, it is by Hari Kanzu, and it is called Twice Upon a Time. It is built upon that software. It is not available anywhere but on atavist.com, and that's because it has all of this crazy multimedia stuff, music, sounds of New York. It's sort of from bygone New York, and you should check it out, atavist.com.
That reminds me, when I was in New Orleans, I went to the World War II Museum, where they have a 4D movie.
Wow. They, like, attack you?
Yeah, I can't really explain.
No, like you can see, like, snow kind of falling, like, between you and the screen. Tom Hanks narrates it. It's pretty great. I recommend the World War II Museum, New Orleans, Louisiana.
Sold.
As always, our most honored sponsor is Tiny Letter. They're a simple way to get an email newsletter off the ground from the people at MailChimp who know newsletters like no one else. Thank you, Tiny Letter.
And we got one more thing. We mentioned this last week. We have a survey going. It's at www.podsurvey.com/longform. It helps us get some information to our advertisers. It's, of course, voluntary. We will not share your email address with anyone. We won't try to sell you anything. You will be entered for a $100 Amazon gift card if you do decide to take it. So help us out if you have the time and inclination.
Yeah, to give an idea, this is just like when we go out and talk to advertisers, this helps us talk about how great our audience is and how you're the kind of people who buy books and technology and all that kind of great stuff, and that helps keep the show afloat. Another way to help keep the show afloat is to leave a review at iTunes. Please do. We really appreciate them. We read them. Here is Evan and Michael Paternity.
Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for coming on. You're in town for you're not in town for the publication of your paperback. You are in town and it coincided with the publication.
Just randomly.
Yeah. But this is not a publicity event that we're doing here. This is not
This is hardcore talk.
Yeah. Exactly. So I was trying to think about where to start, because Driving Mr. Albert was a book that I really was obsessed with when it came out. And actually, dating back to, I was a Harper subscriber and reading, I think it was like a folio, when it came out originally. And a lot of what I was interested in that book was, I was probably like 25 years old. The book came out and it was a book about an adventure that you had, but it also was about you. There was a sort of memoir quality to it, where you were in your life at that point.
Right. Yeah.
And then I was reading The Telling Room and I had this very similar experience of I was expecting a book. I had read about what, you know, the book was about. It's about this cheese, and we'll go into what it's about. But it struck me really strongly that it's actually a book about also about writing.
Yeah.
And a book about a writer in a certain part of the career, and that it's also a memoir. And I would even go further and say they felt like one book to me.
Wow.
In a way.
Interesting. I'm curious. I mean, they're definitely of two parts of one life.
Well, yeah,
and one is the setup for the family to come. And like, I think the one thing about Driving Mr. Albert is that it's a young book, and it's in the background. There's this tension about whether or not myself and Sarah are going to be together. And there's sort of this quixotic journey across the country to come to some epiphany maybe about it, about the rest of your life. And it just so happens that Einstein's brain is in the trunk of the car. So it changes everything. Everything gets very cosmic and sort of speedy, and there's a lot of velocity, which still feels like that part of my life, you know, where I felt like sort of shot out into the world in all sorts of different directions and constantly questioning my own path, you know, what direction should I be really going in here?
Yeah. And that's a lot of that in both books, that sort of reflection is part of the book. I mean, I would assume that happens when you're writing a book anyway, but it's really layered in to the books. Actually, let's before we go back and talk about Driving Mr. Albert, let's talk about The Telling Room, since it's the more recent of them. So first, maybe just set up, if someone hasn't read the book yet, which they should, what you would say this book is about. I'm curious how you, I'm sure you have a well-honed.
No, I don't.
Really?
I feel like I do a very messy job of describing this book.
Should we read like the copy on the back cover?
We should call, we'll call Andy Ward and have him tell you what the book is about. No, it's, you know, it's a book that started as this very simple kind of story about a man living in a tiny Spanish village who was making cheese, and this cheese sort of somehow became world famous. It was from an old family recipe. And I had encountered this cheese in a deli in Michigan just after grad school. I took a job at Singerman's Deli.
Grad school, which you refer to as storytelling school.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there for an MFA in fiction. So I did sort of 2 years and then stuck around for a third. Just trying to delay real life for, you know, 12 more months. But yeah, they had a little newsletter, and I thought my job was to proofread it. And there was a little story about this cheese and this sort of made by this little man, or it turned out to be a big man, in a tiny village. And when I landed up there many years later, just to abbreviate the story, I walked in to the middle of a murder plot, I guess. The cheesemaker was sort of plotting to murder his best friend because his friend had stolen this cheese.
In his telling, yeah. And when you say I landed there, I mean, that's part of what to me was so intriguing about this book. I mean, beyond, it's a great plot. I mean, this character is you even describe at one point as sort of like the character you've been flying around the world looking for.
Yeah, exactly. Every time he opened his mouth, he was the perfect soundbite, or he was so lyrical in everything that he described, from whether it was just describing the harvest or whether he was describing his own desire for revenge. You know, he just had this way of putting things that was very Castilian, very bawdy, but then very poetic. And I was enthralled immediately.
When you showed up, it seemed like you actually didn't really know what it was you were chasing. I mean, did you feel that in the moment? Or when you went back to write it, did you sort of write it more that way, even though when you arrived, you had in your mind, like, this guy could be a book if he's... Or would you really go into it saying, I just want to meet this guy, I just want to know what this is about?
Yeah. I was on assignment for Esquire.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in Barcelona writing about Ferran Adrià, and there was just that one off day. And I had, from all those years earlier at the deli, I had ripped out this little entry about this cheese because I just thought it was so quixotic, really. And I guess it was the beginning of a story or some sort of fairy tale, but I didn't go there thinking this is going to be something. I just went there thinking, wouldn't it be cool to see this guy and go to this place sort of at the top of the world up on the Meseta in mid-central Spain in Castile, and just for one second, for one afternoon, one Sunday afternoon in August, just feel what it's like to be in that village and then to try this cheese maybe.
Yeah.
And then when we got there, he took us into his telling room, which was this cave built into a hill where people gather and they eat and they drink and they tell their stories. And he proceeded to tell this crazy story about how his cheese went from being consumed by royalty in England and Spain and Fidel Castro eating his cheese to this theft of his family heirloom, and then his subsequent grief and desire to kill his best friend Julian, who he claimed had stolen his cheese. It just seemed crazy. I mean, you know, half of me was trying to keep a straight face.
Yeah.
But the other half of me realized really quickly, just because of the sheer force of this guy Ambrosio, that this was like he lost a child. You know, it was intense. And his emotions were huge. I mean, he like wept the first time he told the story. And so, and he's like this 260-pound hulking macho Castilian man. So I was definitely like, when we left that night, it was like 2 a.m. And I turned to my buddy Carlos, who was translating. We were driving out and down the hill from Guzman, the village.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Carlos, what the hell was that? Like, what? I don't even get what just happened there, because he had gone on for 8 hours telling this story. And I thought, you know, really the way he told it with such passion, but he was so emphatic that it felt like he was going to kill Julian, his friend, that night, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was really unsettling in some way. And of course, we never had the cheese because he didn't really have any cheese around.
The cheese was gone. Yeah, it was gone. For the most part. Yeah.
So no, I think when we went there, it just was on a lark. And then driving out of there that night, I was like, wow, that's kind of weird. But I wasn't thinking that's a magazine piece or that's a book. In fact, I wasn't really thinking that hard about it. Later, I started thinking about how can I go back there? And I went back sort of on my own dime a number of times just to get a sense of the place. And I just sort of fell in love with it. People there were living these completely authentic lives, and it just completely sort of ensorcelled me.
There's a sort of nonfiction, this is not going to make any sense, but like nonfiction magical realism quality to this village, like that it could have emerged out of, you know, a novel, just the characters, the types of people that are there.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. And I think when you do some of this work, I'm even just in the magazine work that I've done, I'm always looking for those characters. You know, I'm looking for, I don't know, years ago I did a story about a giant who was living in the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and he was living in a little hovel with his tiny mom. And that felt like it was completely out of some sort of magical realist novel. And there are a lot of stories like that, you know, when I see them, I really am driven to do them if somebody will say yes.
In this case, I mean, you pursued this for a while without that sense of this is going to be X, Y, or Z. You know, this is definitely going to be a book or definitely a magazine story. And it becomes a part of the book. You're wrestling with what is this story going to be? And am I too far into it? And am I too close to the main character? And you even mentioned all the sort of drafts you wrote and lobbing sort of drafts back and forth with an editor. Like the process of writing is really in there. But were there versions of it, of the book, where that wasn't in there, where it was actually just a straight story and you weren't in it at all?
Yeah, I had begun to think that might be the only way to do it, to take a very distant sort of omniscient third person. And then I started thinking maybe I'd become a third person character. Like I would just be the Americano.
Mm-hmm.
There were maybe 100 pages written like that, where it was really third person-y and maybe more than 100. And I thought, in the delusion of writing, that this was exactly what it should be, and I finally lit upon a way to like solve the book. And then it just sat for a little while, and eventually I was told by my editor and by my own better self that it really sucked. You know, like I'd really done something not very good. And, you know, I realized that first person is standing in for the reader, and you're trying to build something. If you're trying to make a very specific story, universal, it felt really important to announce your intentions and mm-hmm. announce who you were and not hide behind something that started to feel divisive, which is what that did, this sort of shift into the third person. It became a little more comic. I was just playing to parts of the story that actually in the end were less interesting than the honest struggle to get it down and to also negotiate this really intense relationship. And I think, you know, that occurs in any story, any yeah. magazine story I've ever done where I've gotten close to somebody. You know, we talk about this all the time. You're cast into this position where you have to betray them at some level by writing a piece in the end and telling your version of maybe their story. So, and I find myself really conflicted still to this day about that. And so that's all in the book. I just figured I might as well put it in there.
Yeah, it's something that I feel people talk about a lot, even on this podcast. We've had a lot of people talk about that. But it's rare that you actually see it woven into the book itself where you're struggling with, you don't want to talk to the friend who betrayed him. You're putting it off. But then you're also recognizing, like, that's not good for this book. That's not the book.
Yeah, because I think you want to believe in the legend or the myth. And the myth was so powerful of this man standing up against the vicissitudes of nature, hand milking the sheep to make this cheese that turned out to be magical. When people ate it, they were reminded of their mothers and their kitchens from, you know, decades before. And so it was this cheese of memory, and he cast it like that. And it stood for purity and love and passion. And it was, he was sort of this bohemian artiste and this poet of the fields. And I really wanted to preserve that. Like, I needed to believe that. So at some point, you know, when it finally turned, and this took some years actually, mm-hmm. and I sort of woke up to the fact that I was here to write a book and to be a journalist or try to be one.
Because we should say for people who haven't read it that you moved there with your family
we were there for 7 or 8 months, yeah. 8 months I think. And so my wife, Sarah, who does this work, she's a writer, really thinks about all these issues, and she was the one who at some point kind of snapped me out of it and just said, you know, you need to ask some of these questions and you need to be less enthralled to Ambrosio and this version of events. You need to, like, step around it. There is a counter story, as there always is, and there's mm-hmm. a counter truth. And, you know, in order to finish this thing, you're going to have to actually deal with that. You're going to give up whatever it is that holds you in place, whatever myth it is you want to continue to believe. And it's funny because I think when, like, a lot of times when you got on magazine assignments, I try to go out open and a little bit blank.
Not filling your head with all the writing about something.
Yeah. And not having a really strong point of view.
Yeah.
I'll be inspired maybe by somebody or think that it could be a story that might look like this.
Mm-hmm.
It might have something, this might be a fable. Like, I could tell this is a fable, but beyond that, I try to hold back on constructing some version or some myth in my own mind before, you know, you've had that chance to engage. But with Ambrosio, I mean, I had the chance to engage, but he was already a myth before I started to consider writing about him. And so I was working backwards against that. There was a countercurrent that kept pushing me back because I kept asking myself, like, isn't there anything in your life that you do just for yourself? You know, why does this experience have to be a book? Why do I have to betray him when I'm in love with his philosophy and his way of life? And I've been taken into this Castilian world that I would never have otherwise been able to, you know, somehow wheedle my way into. So, you know, it's like you're sitting there at 2 a.m. in the telling room in the cave, and they're singing hotas or they're telling dirty jokes or whatever they would normally do if... even if you were back in New York City or Portland, Maine. But in this case, I just happened to be there. And I was hearing all these stories that were hundreds of years old being retold. And I just felt like I was really connected to this deep well of history and, you know, human happening and emotion and joy and hate and, you know, violence. It was really intense. And in some ways, I just didn't want to give that up, that feeling of being connected to it. Because the minute you disconnect to it and you ask for the other story or the other side of the story, you've created a tension or you've driven a wedge into this other relationship.
Yeah, and you're a different kind of actor at that point.
Yeah,
you're not a friend.
Yeah, right. And I think I mistook my friendship with Ambrosio for real friendship, even as I knew I had to write about him. And I still think of him as, you know, I just saw him in London a couple months ago, and it was the same as it's always been, you know, just big hug, and like immediately he starts talking at me. So it was great. But you know, I think he's been really unsure about what this book says about him and sort of what his legacy looks like inside of this book.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to interrupt Evan and Mike for just a second and tell you a little bit about our sponsor this week. It's Atavist Books. They've got their second title out. It's called Twice Upon a Time. It's by the acclaimed author Hari Kunzru. And here's what it's about. It is about when Hari Kunzru moved to New York City and he sort of took as his like imaginary guide this blind composer named Moondog. And if you don't know who Moondog is, you should really buy this book, because the book is this like multi-layered, multimedia masterpiece of a thing. It's got all of this sound, rare music from Moondog, sort of sounds of New York, and it kind of conjures up this bygone era of the city. It's really quite beautiful. It's only $3.99. It's at atavist.com. It's available also in their app for the iPhone and the iPad. So go check it out. And thanks very much to them for sponsoring us. Let's get back to Mike and Evan.
I mean, you mentioned your wife saying to you, you know, you need to pull yourself out of just being, you know, enmeshed with this man and everything that he's all about. But what ultimately answered the question when you said you sort of thought to yourself, well, why can't something just be for me, and why does it have to become this other thing? Did you ultimately say it has to become this other thing because I have a book contract to fulfill, or because that's actually my job, or, you know, what was the sort of answer to that question?
Well, I think it was probably, there were probably several answers, and some of them had to do with deadlines and contracts signed. But even then, you know, I think I was completely willing to give it all back, the advance. And I mean, I would have been willing if I felt like I didn't have something to say. I just always felt like I had a lot to say about it. And it's just this huge puzzle to figure out how to tell someone's story and memorialize a way of living, and to remember a way of life in a dying village that in some ways is really what a storyteller does anyway. You know, mm-hmm. what we're trying to do when we build these stories is, you know, we're memorializing on one level, but we're also leaving a record. It's like the little painting on the cave wall. Whatever it is, it's just some trace that you pass through here and recorded an experience that has, I guess, some meaning to everyone. And so that to me became the puzzle. It was just, how can I tell the story in a way and solve it that is honest? And, you know, I just felt like if I didn't finish this, then what was I doing, you know, as a storyteller, trying to do as a writer, if I didn't have the guts to do it, or I couldn't see my way through to the end of it somehow. Mm-hmm. And then the story was complicated too, because it was meant to be this sort of kaleidoscopic collection of stories within stories. And I just wanted to make sure that would work on some level for people, because there's the sort of this Castilian way of storytelling is constantly interruptive.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you've got footnotes, yeah. You've got asides, you've got, you know, stories within stories, and you could literally listen to a story being told for sometimes years before they get to the point, you know? So with this story, it took years before I got down to the bottom of it.
Yeah. You know, I read some reviews, which is not something, I don't know if you, do you do that? Do you read the reviews?
I read some of them. Yeah. And then sometimes I just stop I read them because I think I want to understand how it's being read.
Yeah.
You know, I want to understand what I can do better, or, you know, where it might work or fail for somebody. You know, I think it's just important to be open to it. I mean, it doesn't mean that I go really high when I get a good one, or go too terribly low when I get a bad one. You know, I mean, it might last for 24 hours where you just are like, oh, okay, I feel good about that, or I feel horrible about that. But then it's just like, you know, you got to get back to work.
Yeah. I mean, the reviews for The Telling Room are fantastic, but there was sort of like some people seemed more into the sort of maximal approach, and some people didn't like it, or they disparaged it as like an overly maximal approach.
Right.
Whereas it seemed like what you were doing was actually the storytelling style that you're writing about. It's nested
Oh my God! Yeah, it's so huge. Yeah. I mean, if you sit in the telling room in Guzman, you know, right now it's whatever. It's 11 o'clock over there, and they've got they're grilling lamb, they've got fresh wine, and Ambrosio Molinas is telling some completely over the top story full of all these digressions. And if you were to try to capture that, you would, you know, hopefully walk away with a book that was maximalist and emphatic and captured that spirit, because that's what it is there. You know, I think if I was writing about people who didn't tell stories or didn't talk much like I did in my first book, you know, then that's a different story. You have to just modulate the keys and what you're doing with it. You just have to think differently about it.
Yeah. There's so much about writing in this, to the extent that I believe this is the only thing I've ever read that explicitly references freelancers paying quarterly taxes. Like, there's a footnote that says, like, I paid my quarterly taxes, which any freelancer would be like, I know exactly what you're talking about. But there's a mention, too, of a book that you almost pursued, a book about John Walker Lynn.
Yeah.
And that's also written about. And
right.
I'm sure you must have reflected on that differently over the process of, you know, doing this book, like mm-hmm. whether you should or should not have pursued that.
Yeah.
And you could have by now have a book out that's a completely different type of book.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So in 9/11, we were in Spain. And when we got into this little tiny village, we checked into the hotel. It was Sarah, myself, and we had one boy at the time, Leo. And we checked into the hotel, and the guy at the desk said, you should probably call home, because he'd seen our American passports. And it was like, I don't understand why. I mean, I wasn't even sure that we had left an itinerary that we'd be staying in this hotel. I just couldn't figure out what he was talking about. And we walked into the hotel room, and it was, they were picking up Arabic TV from Morocco. Mm. And on the screen, it showed the World Trade Towers, and it showed the one falling and then the other falling. And then it would go back to a shot of the two of them standing with smoke coming out. And then that shot would stay on for a long time. And then they would go to the clips again. At first, I just thought it was a movie. I couldn't figure out what it was. So we were there, and we missed this massive event. And as a journalist, had I been here, I'd like to think I would have been in somewhere in it, had something to say about it. But we weren't here for it, and it was a really odd experience not to be here for it. And so I think when in the aftermath, when everybody started to become very focused, especially journalists, on this story and how this story was going to unspool, I didn't feel, I couldn't find the grip on it or something. Mm-hmm. And except when this John Walker Lind got taken, and then I really understood that. I really felt like I had something to say there, and I thought I could write something about that. And in the end, I went and met with his dad.
Uh-huh.
And I got a sense that this was going to be written blind. Like, I wasn't going to get a lot of some of the deep stuff that I really felt like I needed to create the book that I wanted to. And I was really reading Tocqueville. And I was really thinking about, was this guy, John Walker Lynn, big enough as a metaphor mm-hmm. to carry some of these bigger ideas? And I think in the end, I just thought I wasn't certain, and I didn't want to force it. And this, I'd already sort of taken a left off on this dirt path in Spain. And so it just felt like more natural in a way. Cause just, you know, a lot of times, like, you'll be talking to an editor and they'll say, well, what do you really want to write? Like, what's on your mind? Especially with books. I kept saying, oh yeah, well, what's really on my mind is there's this guy with this piece of cheese. And my editor at first was like, oh God, no, not anything but that, you know, because this American audience is not going to be that fascinated by some Spanish cheesemaker. And I was like, yeah, but they will be, because this is so much bigger than that. This is just the way in. This is just the portal to this much bigger book about storytelling and very familiar, universal human emotions and how they play out. And it's really, in the end, about happiness, you know, or trying to find some modicum of happiness in a world that constantly is taking it from you.
And that sort of certainty with which you obviously successfully convinced your editor to go for it, were you able to maintain that throughout? Like, what is your level of sort of doubt and despair along the road? I mean, it was a long, this book was in process for a very long time.
Yeah, it was. And it was, you know, it was really constantly interrupted by magazine work.
Right.
You know, I had carried a full magazine load through all the years that I was writing the book. So we also raising a very young family. And my wife would also be traveling at times. So there was a lot, I felt like we were juggling a lot. And I never lost the feeling for the book. I mean, I had definitely had moments like anybody might where I was just like, this should not be this hard, you know, and why is this so hard? And what am I really after here? But I think those moments of despair were solved in some ways too by the magazine work, because I wasn't stuck on the magazine work. Mm-hmm. It was this constant kind of writing that felt loose and a little more free. At some level, it wasn't, you know, I wouldn't use the word easy, but it felt easy to be in these worlds that I at least I knew how to try to bring to the page. And so then I turned back to the book, and it kind of gave me this energy to constantly kind of reapproach it and question it, and then maybe try to solve it at some level. But it's like, you know, it's sort of, it really is like the marathon ends and you know, then the elite runners finish and, you know, 2:06. And then, you know, you get the 3-hour runners and then the 4-hour runners. And then somewhere way back on the course is the guy who, you know, is in whatever hour 12. And that was this book. But I was just like, there's no doubt I'm going to finish this thing, but it's just not going to be as simple as I thought it was at the beginning. I'm not breaking a world record here.
As long as I keep to my pace, I know I can get to the end. So this is somewhat back to my my original conceit of these being the same book, your first book and second book, which isn't really true. But your wife, Sarah, is, you know, she is a character in this book, and she's a character in the first book in a somewhat smaller way, but a large, you know, figure in this book, both sort of like, you know, the person who's calling bullshit on you sometimes, mm-hmm. and, you know, the person who's also along on this adventure at various times. And given that she's such an accomplished writer in her own right, how did you feel about being the person that made her a character? Like, does she say to you, I'm going to make you a character? If she comes on the podcast, I'll go read all of her stuff and find out when and where she's done that. But I'm curious what the rules are around that.
I don't think she's done a lot of that. And I don't think there are any rules around it. I just think that in those moments when I've written about her, she is quick to say, like, don't make it really mawkish, or don't, like, I want you to be just honest. Like, it's okay. It's okay. You need to make it realistic. It's got to really reflect what those moments felt like. And there were some of those moments were tense, because she's sitting there having delayed her career, sitting in Spain, and I was out, you know, riding around in the fields with this guy who was filling me full of a lot of wonderful hot air. But she saw right through that, you know, and so eventually she couldn't quite hold her tongue. And, you know, like, some of that stuff I really needed to hear, and it came as a surprise to me. What should have been most obvious was that I'd completely kind of gone over, I'd drunk all the Kool-Aid and, you know, was on my whatever 100th bottle of wine. And I think she just was sort of this great steadying influence who does exactly what I do, could think around the corner for me. Uh-huh. And so she, you know, I think in telling it in the book, it just felt very organic. I didn't try to hold back, or sometimes it's a little weird, you know, like sometimes people after the first book, they saw it's dedicated to Sarah, mm-hmm. but it wasn't totally clear that we were going to sort of stay together.
And at so the end of the book, yeah.
Yeah. So people were, you know, people will say, oh my God, so I'm so glad you guys stayed together. And that's a little weird, because it, you know, it's like that moment in our life was we were both being pulled out in different directions, and I think we knew that we were going to make a life together. The question was just, how are we going to do this? You know, how are we both going to travel and write and stay connected and build a family and build a world? And so the telling room was sort of the answer to that, which is you just do it, and then you go on these adventures. I mean, it's a little like Don Quixote. Like, you know, you have to believe that you have to exaggerate the world a little bit to go on an adventure, and you have to exaggerate your sense of purpose in order to do it. You know, she supports all of these ridiculous boondoggles that I occasionally take us on, and I support her in the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it feels like the books put together and individually as well, are the stories of a relationship. They are about this relationship. And there was this one moment, which I only caught it when I went back and I was rereading Driving Mr. Albert. But in the telling room, you talk about this like group of friends that she has. I feel like I'm like invading your privacy, but you did write these in the book.
Yeah, yeah, no.
This group of friends she has, and they have like identical fish tattoos.
Yeah.
Which is also at the beginning of Driving Mr. Albert. You talk about this group of friends and the fish tattoos.
Yeah.
And it felt like this sort of like pulling you from, you know, the person who was sort of uncertain about where this relationship is going to now the person in, you know, the marriage with the kids. And it just was, it caused me to look at the books a different way sort of when I caught that.
Right.
That
I mean, I think there's like this archaeology or something about life as you continue to live it. And so, you know, in some earlier incarnation of myself, I looked at her friends, not knowing them as well as I do now. I sort of saw them as her friends. They're now like in my life too. So they become part of the archaeology of that book, you know, in this sort of deeper way. And in fact, it's in a footnote. It's like sort of part of the sediment of the book too. You know, you build your life on all these, you know, friendships and stories and mythologies. And, you know, part of trying to live as a writer is you're constantly asking yourself, what's the truth here? What's the truth here? Or even what's the my truth here is more accurate. Like, what is my truth here? What am I willing to believe? And so, you know, part of writing about family is really just saying like, this is actually the thing I most believe in. I mean, that's what drew me to Ambrosio. It was just this incredible family of his, and this feeling that he had when he made this cheese, that cheese carried the memory of all of these Molinuses that had come before who'd made this cheese. And this was part of like his purpose or mission on earth. And it was so small, and in some ways it was so absurd, like you're just making some cheese. But he took it so seriously, and it connected him so completely to his past that, you know, I obviously became obsessed with it and started thinking about that in my own life, like my own past and who are the people that I'm connected with. And some of those people pop up in the book. And
I have to point out that the other thing that struck me was, you have this cheese that this man, you know, this sort of like organic but inert item that this man is obsessed with, and it's changed the course of his life. And in Driving Mr. Albert, you have this brain, Albert Einstein's brain, this organic but now inert object that all of these things are projected upon for a character who it's changed the course of his life. They seemed like the same type of fable almost.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like this sort of, I don't know if it's like the MacGuffin or the Maltese Falcon, or there's something about like following the object.
I think it's the MacGuffin, yeah.
It's like the way into sort of beginning to tell a story that's going to explode into something much bigger. Like, I do like that sort of sneaky way of storytelling, like the sort of the Trojan horse comes in and, okay, I sort of know what that is. And then, but meanwhile, you're infiltrating and you're spreading and opening the story out, and then you begin to realize that you're going somewhere really different or interesting, and you didn't quite know you were going to go there. I think that sometimes in magazine stories is really, I enjoy reading those stories a lot. Like when someone pulls it off, it feels like a little bit of sleight of hand or magic that keeps me really tuned to a story. Like when someone's a little bit idiosyncratic, or their mind makes a leap that I wouldn't have thought was even logical. You know, that to me is really intriguing. And so if you do have, say, a piece of cheese or Einstein's brain, and someone lets you in, and like it becomes an easy way to create something like a story arc. But from there, you're pretty much free to go anywhere. And so like in the telling room, the book opens up into many other things in the end, you know, and it becomes much deeper, hopefully, if it works for people, than just this one tale told on a night, you know, in August, the year 2000.
Right, right. So you talk in the book about having gone to grad school and the sort of frustrations of, you know, wanting to be like a short story writer, fiction writer, and sort of everyone casting their stories into the abyss and getting rejections and things like that. But do you feel like that training actually has influenced the way you approach your writing? Like the fact that you went and got, was it an MFA?
Yeah. Oh yeah, completely. I don't see it as being all that different. I mean, I don't feel like I given up on one to do the other. It just is part of the writing project. I just, the even the term nonfiction just doesn't seem very, it seems so flimsy. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like not fiction. I like to think of it like when your editor says, oh, go get a story. They don't go get some nonfiction. They don't ever say that. They're not like, go get me something that's not fiction. You know, it's like, it's pretty like basic. You're trying to tell a story. And some, I've read novels that are basically memoirs that were amazing. And I've read memoirs that call themselves memoirs that were amazing. I read stories that are nonfiction that seem like they can't be nonfiction. Like there's no possible way this is nonfiction. And I've read fiction that feels very quotidian and maybe almost stultifyingly boring. And it feels so realistic that it brings you down or it, you know. So I think all those lines are better scumbled. Like I just don't see it in that sharp sort of defined way. You can't use made up dialogue and not, I mean, there's some basic rules that you have to adhere to. And this idea of like creative nonfiction, I sometimes find the terminology problematic because I think especially people when they begin think, oh, well, that means I get to be creative. When in fact, you know, I think all your decisions get driven by the story as it presents itself to you. So, you know, what point of view you're going to take, what key you're going to tell it in, all those things sort of come in the reporting and the thinking about it. I don't think, you know, you go in thinking, it's time for me to, you know, turn on the Hunter S. Thompson after jets here. And we'll just, you know, just no matter what, this is what it's going to be. And or this is my moment to go Faulknerian on some long nonfiction piece that in the end no one would probably be able to read if you really did that, you know. So, but if it's suggested by the material and you can intimate or reflect or inflect some of that stuff, you know, it becomes richer.
I feel like your magazine work, it varies stylistically a good bit in terms of, you know, I was rereading the Man Who Sailed His House, the tsunami mm-hmm. story, mm-hmm. and you know, that story is entirely second person, but the second person that you're writing to is actually him.
Mm-hmm.
It's not you, the audience.
Right.
And that really struck me as a sort of technique that only a certain story can possibly require that or call for that.
Right. And if you're reporting that story and you spend 5 days with Hiramitsu in Tokyo and then up the coast in his decimated village, you begin to realize that he can't say much about what has happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's saying it all in fragments and you're just collecting all the fragments. And on that piece in particular, when we took the train back to Tokyo, the last hour and a half I was with him, he said, I don't know, he just kind of said it all. But again, in a very fragmented way.
Not
entirely quotable, but he went into some of these deeper feelings that he had been really fighting against and really felt was inappropriate for him to step out and distinguish himself by telling his own story. It was just through all these cultural prohibitions against doing that. But so once I went back and I looked at all the notes and stuff, I realized that there was only really one person I was trying to tell the story to, and it was him, just to tell him what had happened to him. Using all his own stuff, you know, everything he'd given me, so he would have a narrative.
You mentioned being an editor. How did you go from sort of MFA in fiction, trying to figure that out, thinking I'm going to write short stories, to becoming an editor and moving into the world of professional journalism? How did that transition happen?
Yeah, I was in this class taught by a fiction writer, Charlie Baxter, who's incredible, great.
This was at Michigan?
Yeah. Great short story writer, great novelist, and great human being. And he suggested me for a job at this old fiction journal called Story Magazine. So I went down there and I was like the managing editor. And it was really just myself and the woman who ran Story Magazine. And we had a couple of assistants. So I did a lot of editing of short fiction. I worked with a lot of really great writers. Philip Gurevich was one of them at the time who I got to work with. But really some of the best fiction writers in America. We ran some of the first Juno Diaz stories, and it was really cool. But I realized that I was missing the real world in some ways. I mean, it was a complete education to get to do that. But my friend who I'd gone to undergrad with, Will Dana, was at Outside Magazine. And so I had talked to him at one point, and we'd been talking, you know, through the years, but I talked to him at one point, and I was just like, it'd be really interesting to do some of what you're doing. And he said, well, if you're really interested, then, you know, maybe we're kind of looking for somebody, maybe send something to me. I can't guarantee it, but I'll bring it to the editor. And so that opened a little crack in the door, and then I ended up at Outside.
Well, who's the editor then? Was it Mark
Bryant? That was Mark Bryant.
That was a real Outside heyday, I feel like.
It was great. He's just a writer's editor, you know, so he was an incredible guy to get to learn under. And yeah, so that place became sort of this great training ground for all this writing that came later.
That feels like somewhat of the era that's described in Driving Mr. Albert, where you went to do that, but then maybe felt a little lost in the wilderness trying to figure that out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that anytime you go from being like at the center of this, you know, the nervous system, like you're an editor and the phone is ringing, there are ideas, you're meeting with writers. It's like, it's very fertile, and it's incredible. Like there's this just complete effervescence and you walk away from it. And what, you know, the first thing you notice is it's like, it's pretty quiet, you know, and the phone's ringing a little bit, but it's not like people calling up with ideas for right. you to pitch to somebody.
Well,
so
you have to generate all of those return phone calls somehow.
Yeah. So I think that's where a lot of, you know, freelance careers bog down. It's right at the beginning because you're not getting, you can't get any sort of cash flow working, and you know, it's hard. Those first 2 to 4 years can be pretty brutal. But yeah, for me, the first year out was I did the piece for Esquire.
Mm-hmm.
I did Driving Mr. Albert for Harper's, and then I was able to convert that into a book. So it began to get going, but we were in Western Maine. We'd moved up from Santa Fe to Western Maine, so we were sort of in the woods anyway.
Uh-huh.
So it got a little quiet.
So when you settle into magazine work, obviously your work is very eclectic. It's always sort of a difficult question to ask people, like, how do you find your ideas and that sort of thing. But I was particularly interested just gravitating towards some of the stories that I really liked. And there's a number of them, like the guy who's stuck in the airport.
Oh, yeah.
The 15-year layover.
Yeah, the 15-year layover.
But that and a couple of other stories were things that they seemed like they were known. You'd read about that guy on the internet or something.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, the guy in China who's like sort of saving people from the suicide
bridge
that
yeah.
exists. How do you feel out the threshold between something that you feel is out there and people might know about it, and then you say, actually, I can get something more than what people know is there?
Yeah, that's a good question. Some of it's really just a feeling, you know, or I can't stop thinking about that guy,
mm-hmm.
or I can't stop thinking about that situation. This story list of mine is just an ongoing document or documents. I have different ones in some different places, and I have ideas from the very beginning that are still on that list, you know, that I think would be great stories, but they haven't totally insisted themselves or something.
Do you put on that list conceptual stories like a man who's lost his wife or something, you know, something like an idea that you're looking for the characters, the real people to show up, or are they mostly sort of like, you know, a guy who saves people from suicide on a bridge in China and you're sort of...
Oftentimes it's more specific, but it's caught my attention because I feel like maybe that character's big enough to be metaphoric, you know, that there's something in it that's going to be bigger, or that there's some way to tell something bigger through that person. I mean, right, some of them are just random. I remember way back at the beginning, I had no interest in doing celebrity.
Uh-huh.
And until the last, you know, year, I really have never done celebrity. And in the last year, I've done 2 celebrity profiles that have been really fun. Like, I think I'm totally old enough or something to appreciate what that dynamic is.
And did they bring those to you, or did you say these are the ones?
I didn't bring them, but I was in conversation. I said I'm not opposed to doing something celebrity related at this point. I've been doing this a while, and I've made my point with myself, so I'm open to it. But before it was like a personal credo or something. I was like, I'm not going to do that. I have no interest in it. I'm interested in underdogs and normal people and people who have been acted upon by huge forces of history or nature or whatever. And I want to see how these cataclysmic events change a life and how people find a way to piece lives back together. I mean, there was a lot of that in the early going.
Yeah, that seems like a consistent theme, even up to the village that wins the lottery, like these sort of ordinary or classic, like ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances, but they've sort of like been thrust into this world and it's kind of, how do they confront it?
Yeah, it's just so interesting just to take people in this pressurized moment, whether it's like pressurized joy or pressurized tragedy. I mean, early on I did do a Yankee, New York Yankee story. I wrote about Thurman Munson, but Thurman Munson was like my childhood hero. And so that was cool because I did get to go out and meet all these old Yankees and hang out at Yankee Stadium. Like that was about as close to celebrity, I think, as I'd gotten. And that was pretty cool. But I needed, like, that was a story I needed to tell. It took a long time to convince anybody to let me write about Thurman Munson. There was just no reason to write about that guy.
He had been dead for a while.
Yeah, he died in a plane crash in 81 or whatever.
How did you convince someone to let you write about Thurman Munson?
I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And so every time we talked about stories, I was like, you know, my first story is Thurman Munson. You know, this is the one I want to do. You know, I think it was trying to just convince people that that it's worthwhile. So the whole lead to that story is basically written to anyone who thinks it's not worthwhile. Here's why you need to recognize the greatness of this guy who had a kind of average greatness. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't Ted Williams, but he stood for something for me and for a lot of Yankee fans. And so it was eventually I was able to just kind of explain how I thought the story could look on the page, and that maybe that turned some minds to it. What it really came down to, that center of the story, was kind of rehabilitating or recreating or revisiting Thurman Munson in his prime, and connecting him to his family, and then also connecting myself as a boy who was sort of a blind Yankee fan, hearing about the day he died. You know, which for me was like, that was my JFK assassination, you know, and everybody's got their own version of that. So, and the only way that story works is if you put it out there in that very open first person and you tell it like that. The familiar thing is that we all have someone like that. It might not be Thurman Munson, you know, but some sort of problematic hero from the past who stood for something and marked some moment of change for you. And so those currents in the story had to be, I think, strong enough to carry somebody into it who might not care about baseball or care about the Yankees or care about him.
And there you wrote about, you know, your childhood and your sort of love of this character, this you know, professional baseball player, and also your friends and the way you played baseball. And so that's sort of looking back on your own childhood, and then you drop into these stories in different places. Do you feel like it's always you? Like, you mentioned earlier, you know, people coming up to you and saying like, oh, I'm glad that it worked out with your wife. Like, do you feel like people should know you if they, I mean, it might be a little crazy if they, like me, just read like everything you've ever written, but that at the end of it all, that's you, or that's a version of you that's actually separate, that's a little more bumbling or a little more, you know, a little more trying to elicit the story than you would be in your normal life?
That's a good question, because by the sheer fact that you're writing it down, there's something performative in it. And so you're creating a persona. But that said, I'm not really over exaggerating too much. I don't turn myself into like a bumbling character in stories. I mean, I'm on this, like in the story about the suicide bridge, I was on the bridge. You know, I was there when someone tried to kill themselves.
You stopped someone.
Right. We got into like a little tussle on the bridge, and originally wasn't going to write about any of that. I just didn't think it should be in there because I just thought it seemed so improbable. But then it just seemed, when I wrote the piece, when I got to that place in the piece near the end, it seemed incredibly vital to actually put it in there. So, but that person on the bridge, that's all pretty honest. It's like, I think it accurately reflects the moment and my bewilderment and sort of existential nausea and all this other stuff. It was just a very crazy, confusing moment. And then Mr. Chen, the suicide catcher who stops these people from jumping from the bridge, showed up, and his reaction to it was both crazy and comical. And in life, the best moments are the ones that are full of all of this pathos and humor and all of it working in a complicated, confusing way. And you know, when you go to write it, you try to sort it all out. You try to make it more logical. But the person in the stories is me. I mean, it's completely me. And even when I'm not in there, like with the plane crash story, you live with these things. I mean, that's all I thought about for months. You know, so, and I was asking all those questions that get asked in the story.
Yeah, the father in that story. Did you have kids at the time that you wrote that story?
Yeah, I think we had two kids, or we had one and one on the way. And we'd been on a plane during the writing of that. We took a plane to Dallas, and something went wrong on the flight. We lost an engine or something. And when we landed, they asked us to go into the crouch. And the guy next to us kind of like put his arms around us. And I had this reaction because I'd already seen all the evidence of what happens when a plane crashes, uh-huh. where I just sat straight up in the seat and I just looked out the window. I was like, if this is it, I want to see it. But I think that, you know, sort of metaphorically, there is that impulse in a lot of journals. Like, I want to see it, whatever it is. If it's war, if it's suffering, if it's complete unbridled elation, like, I just want to see what that looks like. I want to smell it. I want to taste it. I want to think about it. I want to be caught up in it.
And not to take that down to like a purely logistical level, but it is really interesting, and it comes up in the telling room. You know, the fact that your wife, Sarah, is also a journalist who goes and does these same type of stories, you know, all over the world, witnessing all sorts of tragedy and amazing characters and everything else. And just how do you actually balance that? I mean, a person could say that there's a recipe for disaster in two people pursuing the same job, and it could get really competitive. It could be a nightmare, not to mention the sort of pull of one person needing to go away a lot. I'm just curious. Not to pry, but just how do you actually manage that?
I mean, that's a great question because I think we're asking that all the time. But, you know, like we met in grad school. And so we've known each other as writers from the beginning. And I love what she does. I love the work she does. And I love supporting that. Like, I love being with our kids when she's on the road, you know. And I like the idea, too, that whatever she finds out there, she brings back to us. And we get to hear those stories, and that's part of what we model for our kids, that the world isn't that scary, that those people, you know, who are in China on that bridge, or those people who are in Somalia, you know, they share a lot of the same concerns that we share in our little house in Portland, Maine. And the other part of it with us is I just think we've figured out over the years just how to work efficiently. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there are moments where it feels completely out of control. There are moments where we despair, like, why wasn't one of us a doctor or something, you know, like, or a lot of times we'll like say what we both need right now is like one of those old fashioned 1950s housewives, you know, just living with us, who just takes care of all the stuff, that because sometimes it does feel really crazy. But no, and she's like my partner in crime. So in a lot of what I'm writing, I'm looking for her reaction. I'm wondering what she makes of it. And I think, you know, somewhere in there, when she's writing, she's interested too, you know, and what it's sort of, I know you think of maybe certain people that you're writing for. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I do that as much like specifically, but I do know what it means to be able to take a draft and give it to her, and the constructive things she will say in the name of making it better. And there's never any tension around that. I don't feel it, you know. I'm open to it. I want it. I think sometimes we say, oh, I could go do this on this date, and somebody else says, but I was gonna go here and do that. You know, that's the big negotiation.
And do you have any, I know you have this collection, you said you're working on a collection. Is it a collection of magazine pieces, presumably?
Right, it's coming out in a year, and it's a collection of stories, yeah. Some of the stories are more narrative essays. Some of the stories I've written just have a little bit of that in it, so...
And do you have another big book project in mind? Are you content doing, like, settling back into magazine stuff for a while? Or I guess you're doing it all along.
I have something that I'm trying to work on and figure out. So I'm doing a lot of reading, but I don't want to jinx it completely because I already had another thing that I was working on that I just gave up on. So it's just one of these moments where you kind of have a little bit of time to decide, but then you can't take too much more time because nothing will ever get done. You know, I could be sitting here staring at my belly button 3 years from now. I just, you know, at this point, it would be nice to just kick out some books. I don't want to become overly concerned about if there's a story. You just have to trust that there will be a story because you're going to find the story somewhere in there. And that's true of every book project. You start with just enough detail, but you haven't gone all the way yet in the reporting. I mean, the ones that get sold off of proposals or off of magazine articles. What you're really saying is, I think there's this great promise of more here, and you just have to trust me in the end.
Yeah, but also your last book, I guess, would be... It could be evidence cutting in either direction that you should jump on it and
Get
it done, or that, hey, there's all the time in the world.
Right.
And eventually, the marathoner, you'll cross the finish line.
Battered and bloody.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming.
Oh, man.
Really
thanks for having me.
I've been looking
Such
forward
an
to this
honor
for a long
to get
time.
To come. Yeah, thanks.
So the one thing that you have to do is you have to make sure that Sarah will come on.
Oh, she'll be here tomorrow if you guys want. She's
good.
Your biggest fan.
She's one of our most requested guests. So
that's awesome.
Next time she's in New York.
Cool.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform Podcast. That's our show for this week. I really appreciate Mike Paternity coming into the studio while he was in New York. And thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer of Longform. Thanks very much to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and to our intern, Sarah Button, and of course our sponsors, Tiny Letter and Atavist Books. Check out the new Atavist book at atavist.com. And we will see you next week.